Christian, and Austin Chadwick is my co-host. Today we're talking to Dave Nicolette about mob programming, coaching mob programming. We might get into a little bit of COBOL TDD maybe. And Dave, why don't you tell us about yourself a little bit, and then maybe how did you get into mob programming, and what does it mean to be coaching mob programming to you, and things along those lines?
Okay, well, I've been programming for a while, started in the 70s, got interested in Agile and so forth around 2002, and I've been doing coaching and things like that for, I guess, 15 years or so. And mobbing, well, I heard about it and decided to give it a try in 2014 at a big bank. We had a group of 20 coaches, and there were a lot of teams, like 600 teams. And of course, they were organized in functional silos, as usual. So in order to put people together to do things like regression testing across systems, I asked them to all get into a big room and work together. So we had like 24 people in the first one. And it was very interesting because at first I asked them to give me an overview of what they did. And it turns out that there was nobody who actually understood the whole process end to end. Nobody at all. There were five teams in there, only the testers. And they didn't know what the other teams did or what the other systems were. So whenever there was a change, when data would flow from one system to another, they really didn't know what was going to happen. So there was a lot of fear about making changes to data or data layouts or deleting anything. So it was very good for them to be in the same room and to talk to each other. And we just kind of mapped out the whole process before we started doing anything that you would recognize as mob program. But the value was already happening because they were all together and collaborating. So going from there, I continued to use this approach there at that company and started to use the mob programming routine whenever we could. And the other coaches there were interested in doing that, and they picked that up too, particularly Camille Bell and Mike Bowler. They really liked that. And so you hear them talking about it still and teaching other people. So since then, I've used it for any team that would agree to try it. And I've never really had it had a bad result. I mean, it's always been at least somewhat useful. And occasionally a team would just decide they like it so well that it became their normal way of working. So that's how I got into that, and I'm still doing it and enjoying it.
That's awesome.
What sort of, I guess so teams carry it on. Obviously, you have kind of this idea that people that don't normally talk to each other now working together can make things flow a little bit easier. What kind of, I guess, side effects did you see when people started adopting it? In this kind of like war room scenario, I guess you had a lot of different teams all kind of co-located at the same time and then start mobbing later. What effects did mobbing have? How did it affect morale? How did it affect quality? Things like that.
Well, I'm not trying to be a salesman, but really it only affected morale positively, and it only affected quality positively, and mainly because of the better communication. People no longer had a lot of unanswered questions. They were not so uncertain. They weren't fearful about making changes as much. Yeah. And so those things helped, I think.
That's a really interesting point. So, I think talking about it in terms of fear, right? So, it's probably reasonable to say that the developers became more courageous because they had more access to answers, and that courage led to a gradual confidence, and that confidence led to things like quality and speed and things like that. I guess fear.
You could describe it that way, but okay. When you say gradual, this is a funny word. People say gradual, they say eventually, they say long-term, and we're talking about minutes or hours.
All right.
We're not talking about months.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing with TDD. People will say they'll spend more time worrying about it than than it's worth, because if they would spend a little bit of that time trying it out, they would find out it was okay. Same kind of thing with mob programming. You know, they'll worry about it and discuss it and say, well, this might happen, this might happen. Well, let's try it and see what does happen. How about that? And if it doesn't work, we can stop. And so far, it really, I haven't had to stop.
When I've heard stories like this in the past, I've encountered, you know, some people that say like upper management sees it and doesn't understand it or anything like that. Did you run into anything like that? And how did you deal with it? Well,
initially, and especially in these larger, older companies, anything different worries management because they're not used to it. They don't know if it's going to work. But once the team starts delivering, and then management sees that, you know, time to market is shorter, cycle time is shorter, there are fewer defects, they can see that. And, you know, most of the time, they really don't care how that's happening. They're just glad that it's happened.
Yeah.
I think we've been talking about that recently, someone we were mobbing with, how so many like trust and fear, like problems between teams and management or the rest of the organization start melting away when you start delivering, right?
Yes.
You're delivering value and quality goes up. And I feel like all the shackles that were on the team before start kind of melting away. It's just like, oh, you guys know what you're doing. Keep it up.
And, yes, I've seen that happen.
Yeah, like the need for estimates, the need for micromanagement, like a lot of things go away once results start happening, right? And I think that's really encouraging to hear that happening in other places too. It's really fun. Even in more, yeah. I'm guessing a bank was a more traditional type environment. It wasn't like a.
They are, I'm now on participating in my seventh large company agile transformation. Five of them have been banks, and they're all kind of the same. You know, of course, they all think they're unique, but they have these common patterns like that.
Yeah.
And they're all, you know, most of the time when we do this agile coaching thing, the teams are at a beginner level. You know, someone has told them you have to implement Scrum. And so they're trying to do that, but they don't really think that way. And so it's the same thing again and again at every company as they're trying to do it. And so one example you just reminded me of was, there was a team, I had them in a room, they were mobbing. Okay, great. And they were doing the driver navigator thing and all of that. And I noticed that their user stories looked kind of funny, because one of them was like, ask this other team this question. And then the next user story was, depending on their answer, maybe do user story 3 or 4 if they say yes or no. And they had this series of like 5 stories, and they planned to take 2 weeks for each one of those. Because according to Scrum, everything is a story and you can't talk to anybody except your own team. So they had read it that way anyway. So they had this like 10 weeks worth of stuff here, and it was in the nature of ask a question and get an answer. And so I said, well, what if we call somebody on that other team? So one of the guys did that, and this guy walks in the room and they ask the question and he answers it. So they close that story. And I mean, in like 3 minutes, they closed all 5 stories. And that was a good object lesson for them, because it showed the difference between following this rigid process and just collaborating, just informally talking. And that was a big breakthrough for them. And even for the level they were at, just to find out that it was okay to talk to somebody outside your team, that was a big breakthrough for them too, because for some reason they thought you couldn't.
When I joined the team once, there was it was amazing, because there was two cubicles down there was somebody working, and we had a question, and this was like maybe very early on in mobbing or something along those lines, and it was just like, I was like, oh, let's just go ask them that question. They're like, oh no, we have to put a ticket in to talk to them. And so it was like, put a ticket in to have it go to this person that was 2 cubes away. And so I just said, I walked up, I said, hey, I know you might need a ticket for this, but maybe you can just answer the question. Maybe we can submit the ticket after you give me the answer. And that turned out really well, because it was I came back and the developer, I think the lead developer at the time, was saying, I'm shocked because I've never gotten up to go to talk to that person before. I relate to that story very heavily. So
that's funny the way people are sometimes, because I've seen that several times where people would literally be like one or two cubicles away and they had never talked to each other before. Mm-hmm. And they have dependencies on each other.
Yeah.
That's not even an agile thing. It's just a common sense thing.
Yeah. And it might've been from your encouragement in Mob I was on a while back, but we had a dependency on someone, a different department or something. And just the act of walking over there, instead of just writing a ticket and waiting, but the act of walking over there and talking to the person and then explaining the situation, it built so much empathy between both sides, where we understood what he was trying to accomplish and he understood where we were coming from. And then pretty much the dependency got automated away and he was happy about it because we both understood each other. And and I think just trying to be human helps so many problems.
It does, yeah. Yeah. So, that's a recurring theme, I think, in the kind of work that I do anyway, is teaching managers that humans are not resources. They think that we're resources and they try to manage us like resources and it just doesn't work. They treat us like humans, then it works.
Yeah. So I had a follow-up question. So maybe like the top topic would be like coaching coaches on mobbing. Because it sounds like you've been part of several large, agility improvement efforts, mm-hmm. so to speak, where there's lots of coaches, right? And it sounds like you've been able to kind of share mobbing with other coaches.
It's not really an old thing. You know, it's kind of a relatively new thing, and then a lot of people haven't heard of it yet. So that's been going on.
Yeah, how does that come up? Do they just like another coach hear you mobbing with the team and they're like, oh, what is that? Or is it something you intentionally try to share? Or
well, it's usually, when we have a bunch of coaches at a big company, we're operating as a team. We're not all just scattered around randomly. So when we're doing our team discussions about how we're going to approach some part of the organization, then I'll bring that up as a possible technique we could use. And most of the time so far, the majority of people have not heard of it before, but of course that's changing gradually.
Cool. So what happens? You suggest it, and then some people are interested, some are not. Like, where does it go from there? Yeah.
It's about like that. Yeah. It's like anything else. If some people are interested and some are not.
Okay.
And sometimes once a couple of people are doing it, some of the others will take an interest in it then, because they see that it's effective.
Oh, nice.
The fusion of innovation. I guess in these situations, are you using mobbing as a mechanism to onboard specific skills like PDD or anything like that? Or is it more just to get people talking to each other? Like, what's your maybe primary use for it in these conversations?
Well, it's both. Mostly it's, in these larger companies, it's mostly getting people used to collaborating, mm-hmm. instead of just handing things off. Mm-hmm. And very often, even within a team, they have silos. Now, they'll have programmers and then they'll have testers, and they're using Jira or something like that to hand off stuff it's not really different activities, to people like us. Testing and coding are the same activity, but to them it's kind of two different things.
Yeah.
And so they're handing off and going back and forth and opening tickets for defects, and they haven't even released anything, but they think they have defects already. So there's all this churn going on. So getting them just in the same room and talking is a big step for them. But yes, if the team wants to try something that like TDD, or some kind of automated testing, even if it's, cucumber kind of thing, then that's a very useful way to introduce that, because you don't have to keep telling each person the same thing separately. You can just all work together on it.
Nice. Nice.
I wish that more of the teams I was working with were at a point where they're ready to do that, because most of them are at a point where they're just getting used to collaborating.
I see. Nice. And if you have another coach that's interested in trying mobbing, is there any guidance you give them? Is there any like starter kit, or do you do like mob with them for a little bit and then
just
let
mob
them
with them? Yeah, I don't have a starter kit. But
so basically,
well, I mentioned Emily Bache and I mentioned Llewellyn Falco before we started.
Yeah, so
they have. I think it's really Llewellyn's method, but Emily has given it a name, Saman, which I guess is Swedish for together. So there's a technique to it, to using it in a coaching context. And I like to use Llewellyn's approach as well when I can. But often I just have to go with the flow of what's possible in the organization. So it's not always as well organized as that.
Yeah, it's very hard to be systematic when you have certain pockets of resistance in certain areas. And yeah, so I think I've felt that many times in the past where I just say, you know, take the path of least resistance and make as much movement with that momentum as possible. And then, mm-hmm. and then that will slowly erode the edges, I guess, maybe to use a water analogy.
Yeah, good. When I'm coaching a team, I usually don't come at them with a bunch of buzzwords and things. You know, you asked if I use this to teach TDD and things like that. Well, yes, but I don't go into a team and say, hey, you guys should do TDD.
Yeah, we're because gonna mob and TDD.
They don't care. You know, they've been doing programming for 15 years and they've never been fired. So they don't have any reason to change the way they work. But if we say, well, the organization, you know, your boss says, you have to reduce time to market. You have to reduce defects. And they say, well, we're doing everything we know. I said, well, let's try this.
Yeah.
And then that's a way to ease it in there. And they have a reason to think about it.
Mm. Yeah, so motivation and then a pathway can do a lot there. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, I like that a lot. I think I was talking with Sean Cowan, who we had on the show previous. I was talking the other day, but we had him on the show earlier in the year. But he was saying, I forget, it was one of the signers of the Agile Manifesto, but I think he was being coached by him. And every time he said the word Agile or said an Agile buzzword, he like made him stop and say like, say it again, but don't use the buzzword, you know, or don't use
the word. Oh, that's great. Agile. I like that.
Yeah. And I was just like, that is a good exercise. So then you have to use words that the people you're talking to know, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's good.
Okay, cool. Something else that jumped out to me was my mobbing experience is typically in a smaller setting as far as number of people. So it's mm-hmm. usually like, I don't know, 3 to 5. I think the largest I've been in is 8. I think Chris has had some large mob experiences, but it sounds like that might be more of a normal thing for you when you have I guess when the system has a lot of people in it that are trying to collaborate, right? So
I would say that's pretty normal for me. But you know, to do mob programming sort of by the book, if you will, really something like 5 to 8 people is good, because it gets to be too many people.
Yeah.
You know, you're just constantly, well, it's just too many people to really be effective when you're just doing heads down development and you all know what you're doing. It's not coaching, it's just working. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to have a group of 20 trying to do that.
Yeah.
But for some of these learning exercises and for coaching purposes, it's okay, it works okay at 20 or so.
I find where you know, many people have very esoteric, disparate pieces of information that are siloed in many different areas. You can go to any number, because it's really like, it's really just, okay, popcorn right now. Who has this piece of information? Who is that? Who is that? Who is that? Who is that? And then synthesize it, right? In any case, I think that can make an effective mob no matter what the size is. But as long as people can learn or contribute. And so I find the bigger mobs are always people that should be talking to each other that haven't been. And getting that to then culminate in some end result. And so... Mm-hmm. You know, even in our context, I've seen some you know, 12 person mobs get together to solve a single problem because lots of people have random pieces of knowledge that don't seem to fit until you see them in the big picture. And the only way to get a big picture is to get that snapshot from everybody at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't ask me the details because I don't remember them, but I did one of these remote mobbing things that we've been doing during the pandemic with this Munich group. I don't know if you guys were in that one. And they did,
it's been
a whole Saturday, you know, and they had four different formats of mobbing that we tried.
Nice.
And so there's variations on this, and you can fit the situation and the people, you know, you can do it in a way that works for them. It's not about one set of rules.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there. And that's what I love about it is mobbing is an evolving thing. It's not a static thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's constantly being experimented with and new ways and new patterns. And there is no rule book, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. 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 Sometimes you get lucky, you know.
Yeah.
I was doing this at a different bank. They call everybody a development team, you know, because before we got there, they had another round of Agile. And those coaches said, all your teams have to have like exactly this many people, you know, and they're all just developers. So we get there and they have 800 teams that they call development teams. Well, in an IT department, there's a lot of other activity besides development. So all these teams are doing different things. So they said, okay, Dave, you go show this team how to do cucumber. Okay, so I go to this team and we get together in a mob setting. And they're not really doing programming at all. And they don't have a UI. So what can we do? And so we're going through Ruby, teaching them Ruby. And at one point, the business analyst on the team was at the keyboard. And she says, well, can cucumber read Excel? So I said, well, not cucumber, but Ruby can read Excel if there's a gem. Let's look for a gem. So we found one. It wouldn't let us write. So we found another one. Okay. So we're writing this Excel file. Okay. And she says, well, can it do CICS on the mainframe? I said, yes, there's a gem for that. I know that one. And I said, well, where are you going with this? And she says, well, what our team does, 30 hours a week, we are taking fields out of an Excel spreadsheet and typing them into a CICS screen to enter them into this back-end system.
Yikes.
So she got the idea. She's not a technical person, but she got the idea, well, why don't we use Ruby, read the spreadsheet, and dump it into the CICS application. So they're using Ruby and gems that you would normally maybe use with Cucumber just to connect the spreadsheet with a back-end application. And what happened there was the team went from spending 30 hours a week doing that to spending 30 minutes a week doing it. So, and it just came about because everyone was in the same room and talking about what they do.
Yeah.
So instead of learning how to do, you know, Gherkin and all of that stuff, they used the session to build the script and it helped their work. But you never know what could happen. But it's like I was saying before, like I told Chris, I haven't seen a bad result come out. It's not necessarily the result you expect, but it's usually a good result.
No, I think you failed as a coach. They didn't learn cucumber, so
that's right. They had no need for it. Well,
nice.
It's okay with me if people don't need things. It just makes life easier. Remove something instead of add something.
Yep. Yeah. So. I guess something, it seems like you have a lot of experience with this kind of like mixed group of people, maybe programming, maybe not, maybe a large number. Do you have any like tips and tricks you use when you're kind of like, hey, I have a set of 20 people, we're all together and we're learning how to better collaborate? Like, is there anything you do to start out with like a mobbing session of that kind?
I can't really think of anything I do on purpose. So I'm not sure how to describe that.
Yeah.
You got to get them started talking to each other. Okay. Usually whatever their goal, there has to be some goal, I think, you know, and just let's be agile. It's really not a goal. But like a team that I'm working with now, the biggest pain point they have right now is the time it takes them to do regression testing before they release. It's always a big crunch. So that's where I'm focusing. Well, let's reduce that. Let's alleviate that pain point. And then we'll see what the next pain point is. So I don't go in there already thinking about what we're going to do. I find out what they need first. And then we just go from there. And because it's their problems that we're solving, I haven't really had any problem getting them talking. Often too, when I go in there and I tell them, you know, your management says we're going to do this agile thing and they've hired 50 coaches. But I don't really care about agile. You know, I care about results. And very often I find that all the defenses just drop and say, okay, good. Let's get some results.
Nice. Yeah. So it almost like, and maybe this is Woody's, like what I call Woody's like second definition of mobbing is basically like, let's work well together or something like that for flow efficiency. It's almost like, yeah, we're going to go mob. And what we're going to do is we're going to be in a room and then we're going to problem solve together. And that's kind of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good start.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's, it's fascinating how much magic, so to speak, happens with just simply doing that. Right. And, mm-hmm. And I think, I'm guessing there's more you're doing that's quite skilled, you know, as far as facilitating the conversation so it doesn't become destructive or aggressive or blame and that kind of stuff. But
well, I do that, but I don't know how to explain it.
Nice.
Is there, would you say that, you know, because I think we talked a lot about the communication and the lack thereof beforehand. Is there anything that you look for specifically or any kind of like, common signs that people should be talking that aren't or anything along those lines? You know, maybe something that you notice that you feel might warrant introducing something like mobbing or like any other interpersonal exercise? Or is it just, you know, go with the flow?
Well, mostly go with the flow. I think that in these bigger companies, the way the teams are structured and the procedures they have are so formal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're using indirect communication or via shared network drives or a wiki or a Confluence or something instead of talking. Now, that's an indicator right there. They need to talk. And once they're in the room or they're on a call, like this year, they're on a call, there will be a couple of them who do all the talking and then all the rest of them don't talk. So you have to reach out to them and invite them to say something. But they do have things to say and contribute. It's just that they are kind of overwhelmed by the talkers. So there's a little bit of that to do, facilitation to do. It's not really hard.
Yeah, I found that a lot in mobbing too. Just, you gotta do it in a safe way and make sure it's the right time. But often I found that in many cases, just calling on someone to be like, hey, what do you think about this? Mm-hmm. You know, or for trying to amplify the unheard voice, because yeah, there is certain personality types who have a lot of great insights, but they're just waiting to be asked.
Yeah. True.
Cool. So maybe it might be fun to transition for a little bit here to COBOL TDD. I'm fascinated in this story and how could this even happen? You know.
Oh well, it's interesting that people are taking an interest in it. But back at that same first company where I met Camille and Mike and some of the others, probably people you know like Jeff Morgan, you know, Cheesy, and some other people were on that. It was a really good group. We were doing a weekly code dojo thing, and we were going to do a TDD exercise. And somebody mentioned COBOL, someone in the room. And I said, well, of course, this would be impossible with COBOL. And in those days, I wasn't as mellow as I am now. And I said, and this word impossible was a kind of a trigger word for me. So over the weekend, I hacked up some kind of a unit test framework that was pretty crude. And the next time we got together for a dojo, I said, well, let's do it in COBOL.
Nice.
And we did that. And there were some COBOL programmers there who were, you know, learning Java and things like that. And so now they were in their element and they were showing the Java kids that they could do it too. And they had a lot of fun. So yeah, the framework still exists. I've expanded on it a little, but, and now people are getting interested in it. So I think I'm going to have to pay more attention to it. Apparently COBOL is making a comeback now. I've been seeing stuff in the news about that. So I guess we'll have to pay attention to it again.
Yeah. I think the old saying is if you open source it, then there will be pull requests. I think that's the...
Yes. Yeah, I've got some pull requests waiting for me now. It really surprised me to see that. Wow, somebody noticed this.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's good.
Well, I think this is only rumor mill for me, but I've heard that there are well-paying jobs in COBOL because companies need to make changes to that code that was written a long time ago. And so
I hear that too, you know, and when the pandemic was going and there was this problem with unemployment benefits getting turned around, but it was too slow. They said the state of New Jersey is desperate for COBOL programmers. They're paying high rates. And so I looked at their site. They had one job opening. You had to move there. You know, you had to work there in person in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And they were going to pay $40 an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, these are rumors.
Yeah, rumors. Okay.
But there does seem to be growth in that area for a couple of reasons. One is the older generation is retiring. Mm-hmm. But these systems, they're not easy to replace. You know, there's decades of code there. Well, IBM decided when they invented the 360 to make backward compatibility a design feature. And prior to that, you know, if you had your software on your computer and you needed a new computer, you had to throw away all your software because backward compatibility wasn't a thing. So they did very well with that. Now, so if you had an executable that you compiled in 1964, it'll still run. Mm. But the downside of that is people never upgraded their software. They just accumulated it over all these years. And it's all full of hidden business rules and things that it would be a real hassle to extract that and rewrite it. So mm-hmm. that lives on. Then another factor is the cloud. You know, if you look at, I don't know if you guys pay much attention to mainframes, but if you look at the current generation of mainframes and look at all the features that they have all the features of a cloud infrastructure of something like AWS. It's like a cloud in a box and they are being used as backends for cloud. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that now they can run Docker, they can run Java, they run everything. Mm-hmm. And they can run like 8,000 Linux VMs simultaneously while they're still running their old workloads of batch and all that stuff. Yeah. So they're reborn. So there's these two different directions that are driving the job market. And so there's more demand, but it's not this magic panacea, like you were saying, where you make $1 million. It's not like that, but at least it is a realistic career option now.
Yeah. And I imagine that probably the skill that COBOL probably needs the most these days is something like test-driven development and continuous integration and those sorts of things to make sure that those systems live on and can have features added to them without a lot of fear. Because, you know, probably just about every legacy environment, it's always more expensive to replace it than to...
Yeah, I think you're right on with that. Because, you know, if you look at go to a typical Java or C# shop, you know, they've got all the tools you could possibly want for CI and CI/CD and TDD and all that. And yet the legacy code is often very messy.
Yeah.
When you go to a mainframe shop, you look at the COBOL. Well, you know, in the 80s, when everybody was saying mainframe's going to die, well, most of us went and turned our attention to other systems, but some stayed. And the ones who stayed are the ones who cared about it. Yeah. So what you see is really clean code.
Yeah.
but no tools and no concept of TDD or anything like that. Yeah. So yeah, there's kind of mismatch, you know, between the old and the new. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're quite right. Introducing that those techniques and some tooling for it, it's a, the market is ripe for that.
And that's the whole thing that led to the COBOL TDD framework you started to create there. I think is a good example of, I think there's this always been this synergy between like TDD testing and mobbing, but I think part of it is there's a lot of conceptions about what's testable and not. And I'm one of those weird people where anybody says, oh, that's not testable. I'm like, no, I bet we can find a way. Yeah. And I'm like, no, let's try. I bet we can find a way, you know? And so I get a lot of like joy out of like trying to make what is called the untestable testable. And
You and I would be dangerous on the same team.
there was one example where it reminded me of your story where it was kind of like, there was like a transpiler of some kind and it transpiled most of the testable code, but there's some code that it didn't. Basically it was set it up so it's not testable. And so I did what you did, which is you basically make like the dumbest, simplest, at least in my case, unit test framework, right? It was like, I made an assert method that, you know, then you could start writing tests and, you know, it wasn't beautiful. Didn't have all these like green and red, you know, trees of what's failing and what's not. It basically like blow up everything if one test failed, but at least the stack trace would tell you where it failed, you know? And so, I have yet to see either from me or from others see that challenge proven wrong that it is truly not testable. I haven't seen that yet.
Have you ever worked with Oracle ADF?
No.
Okay. Well, there's enough probably, said then.
Yeah. There's probably a lot that is not testable, but right. I still like to think there isn't.
if you can test Oracle ADF, please reply to the comments and tell us that you can.
Well, you know, what makes it hard to test drive, especially that, is it takes an Oracle schema and just generates a CRUD app.
Yeah, yeah.
So that there's no real, they're not really writing source code.
Maybe the generator is what's tested, or maybe the end result, maybe it doesn't need to be tested because there's no regression.
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, we like TDD, but it really applies when you're writing code.
Yeah.
And if you're just generating code, then whoever owns the generator is responsible for that.
Yes. Yeah. And
you just actually get what you get.
So it's funny that you say that. I've actually used, I've created a T4 template generator to generate a CRUD application in Microsoft MVC and Razor. And I generated all the unit tests that would do the regression on that Razor. And then, and so anytime that I needed a new version of a CRUD application, I could just create a schema and have all the unit tests already written for me. And then I would then modify the unit tests to do any additional functionality. So there's probably something to be said with saying that like 99% of an application is boilerplate, and then like the 10%, you know, the 1% that you need to actually work on can be can already have unit tests around all the other stuff for you. That's definitely doable. And I
yes, it is definitely that. Yeah. Even with ADF, I mean, because you can drop in. It's got a whole lot of stuff baked on top of JSF.
Yeah.
And you can drop in POJOs at certain points to do custom work. And so you could test drive those. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what's the point of test driving generated code? It's already there.
Yeah. You could always test drive the generator, but I think the reason to test drive generated code, or sorry, the reason to generate tests from the generator, I think the reason that would be a nice thing is if you're dumping it as a template, a starting point for a group to work on. Mm-hmm. But if there are no humans involved, then I think there's less requirements for regression tests as well. Because the humans ultimately are the ones making the mistakes, right?
That's true. Yeah. Well, it just goes to show it. Everything depends on context.
Right? Yeah.
We could say something is a good idea. Well, it's a good idea in a context,
yeah,
yeah,
and maybe not relevant to another context.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think we'll close it out there. But I think that kind of ties back into what we were saying earlier when you were saying like mobbing for results, right? So when you start collaborating well, you start automating a lot of this stuff with that's been kind of a cool theme throughout this conversation. Dave, is there anything you'd like to plug or share before we close out the show?
Well, I don't really have anything to plug or share.
Well, yeah, it's, maybe we'll put a link to your COBOL TDD repo and you might get some more pull requests.
Okay. I can send you that if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. Thank you, Dave, for being on the show. This was a fascinating conversation. To all of our viewers, if you know somebody who is trying to be coaching to other coaches to mob, they might be interested in this video. You might want to share it with them. Or if you know a COBOL programmer that hasn't done any TDD, you might want to share this video with them as well. So please share, like, subscribe, and thank you for joining us. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.